Good day, and welcome to the ENERGY STAR Enhanced Testing and Verification conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kathleen Vogts with ENERGY STAR at EPA. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Marvin, and welcome to all of you to the ENERGY STAR call on Enhanced Testing and Verification. My name is Kathleen Vogts. I'm with EPA, and I will be walking through the presentation with you this morning to describe our plans on enhanced testing and verification for ENERGY STAR. To start with, I want to recognize that right now we have about 700 people registered for the call today. I thank you all so much for your interest, for your time listening in on this call today. Due to this high interest, we were not able to conduct this as a webinar, and hopefully you received our messages to that extent. We did send the slides to everybody yesterday, and if you haven't been able to access them yet or haven't been able to find them, we also have them available on our website. If you go to energystar.gov/MOU, the presentation is down toward the very bottom of the web page. So right now I will just ask all of you to please open your presentations so that you can follow along with the presentation today. After I finish going through the presentation, we will have time for questions, and Marvin will assist me with that, who is our operators on the call. And also, since today is focused very broadly on program-wide issues, we request that your questions be as broad as possible. We do have 10 product-specific calls and one call on labs, accreditation bodies, and certification programs that has been scheduled over the next 2 weeks to facilitate further discussion on those specific topics. I would like to structure the discussion to the extent possible along those lines. If you now turn to slide 2, I will talk a little bit about the background and purpose for this call to make sure that all of us are on the same page. As you know, the reason for this call is to discuss enhancements to the ENERGY STAR program. While this set of efforts is cross-cutting across all products, we have been making enhancements together with our partners for the past 15 years. As ENERGY STAR has grown as a program, we and our partners have realized wonderful recognition with the label and recognize that with that recognition comes greater responsibility and the need to ensure that every ENERGY STAR labeled product delivers the expected savings to the consumer. Over several years, we have been adding more rigor to the program as we grow, and we are at a point now where we think it makes sense to implement further enhancements across all of our ENERGY STAR products. This presentation will focus on these enhancements and our proposed approaches. Slide 3 covers our historic and current approach to ENERGY STAR qualification and testing. Before I get into the details of these enhancements, I want to make sure all of you are aware of our current approach for qualifying ENERGY STAR products. While some of you know these details intimately, we also have participants on the call who are not manufacturers and do not know all the details of how we work. First, we enter into formal agreements with partners that outline the terms and conditions for partnership. We issue program identity guidelines as part of this agreement. Manufacturers then test their products based on our specifications. For most products, manufacturers can decide what lab to use for their testing. However, in a few cases, we already do have lab accreditation requirements in place. Also, for most products, manufacturers are allowed to label before submitting their qualifying information to EPA. This could be up to 1 year for many products. Once EPA has the information, we add it to the list of qualified products based on the manufacturer-provided data. We currently have verification efforts in place for a limited set of ENERGY STAR products, such as windows, vent fans, and lighting. The enhancements we are discussing fall within this compliance audit program described on this slide, and we will help grow this program, this compliance audit program, to cover all ENERGY STAR products in a consistent manner. Now that I've presented our current approach to ENERGY STAR qualifying products, you may still wonder why we are embarking on this enhanced testing effort. Slide 4 describes this in more detail. In addition to the need for us to add more checks to the system as our program grows and our testing requirements become more complex, there are a number of external factors worth highlighting. With the proliferation of green standards and voluntary labels, has also come a concern over greenwashing and increased scrutiny of voluntary programs. We have also seen a lot of scrutiny focused on Energy Star recently. The Inspector General recently completed investigations of the Energy Star program at EPA and DOE. The GAO also completed an investigation very recently that was focused on Energy Star. The new requirements I am presenting today build off the new partnership agreement, the Memorandum of Understanding between EPA and DOE that we signed in September of 2009. This agreement specifically describes the changes to the Energy Star program with regard to enhanced testing. Specifically, this agreement states that Energy Star will increase verification efforts to identify and address product performance issues. It also indicates two ways of doing this. One, through qualification in an accredited lab with submission of data to EPA prior to labeling, and two, through enhanced off-the-shelf testing through a combination of EPA-DOE testing, manufacturer-funded in EPA-DOE-administered testing, and other third-party testing. These two elements described in the partnership agreement are described further in the next slide on key elements of enhanced testing requirements. The reason for the testing and reporting prior to qualification is to ensure that EPA has testing information on all products prior to labeling. Adding the requirement for testing from accredited labs will also ensure that the testing is conducted in a way that is repeatable and representative of the products that enter the market. The second element of verification testing serves to ensure that products continue to meet the Energy Star requirements regardless of changes in the production process. This is important for providing assurance to consumers that the Energy Star products they buy are delivering the savings they expect. Slide 6 depicts the key approaches we plan to take to address these two key elements. For qualification testing, we will require test data for each product from an approved accredited lab. Where partners are already working through an approved third-party certification system, they will be able to provide this data to EPA through that system. For verification testing, we are looking at two approaches. One is the market-based testing approach we will discuss today, and the other is the government red testing program that DOE has initiated, which is in italics on that slide. Slide 7 describes the government testing in a bit more detail. The DOE testing program will verify the energy performance of Energy Star products in the marketplace. DOE has already started testing some of the most commonly used appliances this month through this program, and the process on slide 7 shows how DOE is conducting this verification testing. I now want to direct your attention to slide 8, describing the market-based testing program we are going to discuss today. This market-based testing program involves manufacturer-funded testing in which our partners work with approved non-government entities to have products tested in accredited labs, both for purposes of qualifying products and for purposes of demonstrating continued compliance through verification testing. The general process that will apply to all Energy Star products and this proposed market-based testing regime is as follows. To qualify products, the manufacturer must first have the product testing in an approved and accredited lab. The lab then sends the information to EPA in order for EPA to review the submission and add the product to the list of Energy Star qualified products. The partner will then be allowed to label the product and will also be responsible for providing any new data to EPA if changes to the model result in changes to energy consumption. On the other side of that slide, to verify product's performance, third-party administrators will select products for testing either once or twice a year. The manufacturer will then pay the third party to administer independent, off-the-shelf, or off-the-line witnessed testing. Once the third-party administrator has had the products tested, they will share the results with EPA. If the models are determined to fail to meet the Energy Star requirements, Energy Star will delist the product, require a set of corrective actions, and determine the cause of the failure in order to avoid future problems. Before getting into the details on these requirements, I want to share with you our plans for developing and finalizing these requirements on slide 9. The documents we have shared to date, the conference call today, and the conference calls we have scheduled over the next 2 weeks are intended to share our proposed plans with our very broad group of stakeholders. We have already received comments on the aspects of our enhanced testing and verification efforts described in the enhanced program plan for Energy Star, and we will seek further comments on our general approach presented today, as well as the product-specific considerations. We will then develop draft guidance documents that capture these requirements and distribute for further review, hosting additional calls as appropriate. The next part of my presentation will focus on three aspects of these proposed requirements. In the agenda for proposed requirements, first I want to discuss implementation issues associated with these new requirements and share with you the process we propose for implementing and reporting on new testing requirements. Next, I will discuss two product-specific approaches to testing. One is qualification and quality assurance testing, and the other is third-party certification and verification testing. We did receive comments already recommending that we model our requirements after existing programs, including current industry third-party verification programs and safety testing programs. I think you will see in this presentation that we are considering these recommendations and do intend to leverage existing programs where possible. There are several issues we need to address when looking at how we will implement such a program. Slide 11 describes these implementation issues, which include new partner commitments that allow our partners to sign on to these new requirements, general requirements for labs and accreditation bodies, requirements for administrators of verification programs, the process for submitting all of this testing data, EPA's approach to compliance and enforcement, and finally, how we plan to communicate test results. I will start on the new partner commitments on slide 12. In order to make all these changes, in order to add in all these new requirements to our Energy Star specifications, we will need to be making changes to our partner commitments. The first new commitment will be the requirement for testing in accredited labs prior to qualification for Energy Star. To phase in this requirement, we will set a date after which all products qualified in that category will need to meet this requirement. For products qualified prior to this date, we will provide a reasonable period for products to be retested and have another date by which they need to be retested. Another addition to the partner commitments will be the requirement for qualification information prior to labeling. We will also explicitly require models to be retested if there are changes in components made after qualification that impact the testing results. It will be clear across all specifications that products will need to meet Energy Star requirements for the conditions in all markets in which they are sold, for example, at the different voltages. We will require partners to participate in the corresponding verification testing program, which we are developing through this process. Finally, we will look across all of our product specifications to ensure consistent commitments as appropriate. For lab accreditations, we have outlined our initial thoughts on requirements for accreditation bodies providing the lab accreditations. This is on slide 13. First, the accreditation bodies will need to register with Energy Star and provide information about the labs they are accrediting to Energy Star. Next, we will need to consider if participating in round-robin testing is necessary as part of this lab accreditation process. And as mentioned before, we will look to make reference to this being a signatory to one of the international lab accreditation cooperation mutual recognition arrangements as part of this. The labs themselves will need to be accredited by an approved accreditation body. We are looking at ISO 17025 as a base requirement, but are open to considering further requirements as necessary. We also contemplate the use of in-house labs at a product level so long as appropriate controls are in place and depending on whether the purpose is for qualification or verification. Finally, we will look at options for interim approval of labs for new specifications that go into effect and potentially for rolling out some of the new requirements for existing specifications. We did receive comments that encouraged us to use the ILAC and IAF infrastructure for as umbrellas for the accreditation bodies, which is something that we intend to do. We have received requests for more details to define accreditation, which we start to do here, but we'll continue to define in even more detail. Finally, there were concerns about costs associated with accreditation and whether it was necessary. While we do recognize the increased burden associated with using an accredited lab, we also believe that the value offered by these labs in providing reliable, consistent test results is important for conducting the rigorous testing demanded by and associated with ENERGY STAR. Another implementation issue has to do with the way verification programs will be administered, as described on slide 14. Manufacturers will be required to work with administrators of verification testing programs to have their products tested in labs annually. The verification program administrators will then share their test data with EPA and DOE. We will have requirements for these administrators, which I will describe in more detail in later slides. There will also be a selection and approval process for these administrators, which will vary based on the two models we are considering. With the new testing requirements, EPA will need access to test reports for qualification and auditing purposes. On slide 15, we discuss the issue of submission of test data. We will have a new process for submitting data to go along with these new changes. Depending on the specific requirements for a product category, we plan to require submission of test results from an accredited and approved lab. In the case that the test results are not certified, ENERGY STAR will need to implement a system for auditing test reports to ensure that the submitted results match the actual test report data. In terms of enforcement, we plan to publish a standard protocol for responding to product testing failures, including the process for disputing test results, as well as the typical corrective actions we would require. This is described on slide 16, enforcement protocol. It is important to note that either failing testing or refusing to participate in testing will both be violations of our partnership agreements in which manufacturers agree to label only products that meet our requirements. We, and I know you as well, take these commitments very seriously. The final implementation issue I will address on slide 17 is our communication of these testing efforts to specific audiences. We would like these efforts to be as transparent as possible, and as such, we are considering the best way to share these efforts and results. We plan to communicate the testing results to three main types of audiences, providing the appropriate level of detail for their interests. Within the U.S. government and also with partner countries, we plan to share a list of products tested each year with a summary of test results. For products that fail testing, we will share detailed test reports. For the retailers and energy efficiency program sponsors, we plan to share the total number of models tested and immediately inform them of failed and delisted products. Finally, for the general public, we plan to provide an annual summary of testing, including the total number of products tested and the number of models delisted. We also plan to post to our website the products that failed and were delisted. Now I will shift gears and talk about the two testing models we are considering on slide 18. As noted on this slide, under the quality assurance testing model, we plan to address consumer electronics, IT and office equipment, and lighting products. For all the other products listed here, we plan to use a third-party certification and verification approach to testing. As noted here, we do plan to look at the possibility of allowing third-party certification and verification as another option for those products covered under the qualification and quality assurance testing model. You will see as we walk through the following slides that these two models here are quite similar. I will try to highlight the differences as I describe the two models, and hopefully they will all be clear. I will start by walking through our proposed approach for qualification and quality assurance testing on slide 19. As I mentioned, the products covered under this model are consumer electronics and IT products, as well as lighting products. This approach is consistent with our current approach to lighting. And for consumer electronics and IT products, we thought this model would work as it takes into consideration the wide number of configurations of products, as well as the short lifetimes of many of these products that make it more practical to conduct spot checks for verification purposes rather than having all the models retested within a certain number of years. We have developed a program for computer verification testing that is similar to what we are envisioning for the quality assurance testing component of this model. There are several components to the qualification and quality assurance testing model that are included in this presentation. I describe these main elements on slide 20. First are qualification requirements, and next are all the verification requirements, including both the administrative aspects of verification testing, as well as the specifics on lab requirements and processes for identifying, selecting products, and obtaining models. I will also touch on the partner responsibilities under this testing model. On slide 21, for qualification purposes, these products will ideally be tested in third-party independent labs with specified accreditations. We are open to considering the use of in-house labs on a product-specific basis, but only if proper controls are in place. We did receive concerns about this requirement regarding costs, capacity of labs, and time to market considerations. There were also recommendations to consider testing programs that allow for testing at manufacturers' labs with appropriate oversight. We plan to discuss these options further with you during the product-specific calls, but believe that through leveraging of existing testing efforts, we will find a workable solution. We currently have lab accreditation requirements in place as described on slide 22. We have them in place for lighting products for both qualification and verification testing purposes. By making use of the existing accreditation infrastructure for laboratories, our goal will be to put lab accreditation requirements in place for qualification that ensure quality testing results for all ENERGY STAR products. I will now move on to the verification testing piece of this model on slide 23. Since this approach only includes spot checks on products, it is important to have one third-party entity who's responsible for conducting all the administrative aspects of the program, such as product selection, working with labs to conduct testing, and tracking the testing results. EPA and DOE plan to select one third-party entity to administer verification testing for a product category. In selecting this entity, we will have a range of selection criteria, including the costs of testing to manufacturers. Qualifications will include proficiency in managing testing and demonstrated impartiality regarding the outcome of testing. For the verification testing on slide 24, we believe it is especially important to require testing from third-party independent accredited labs. However, we will look at the possibility of witness testing, such as the type of testing allowed for meeting safety standards. In either case, a third party will need to be involved. We did receive additional comments requesting the use of in-house labs with appropriate accreditation for the verification testing, but at the same time, there's also strong support for only having third-party independent testing labs do the conduct the verification testing under this model. We look forward to continued discussion on this topic. Under the quality assurance testing model, the process of selecting products is especially important since only a limited limited number of models tested. The current plan is to have a selection panel that helps decide which models to test. Slide 25 describes this in more detail. There will be some random selection of models as well as targeted selection of products. The targeted selection will be based on factors such as products from manufacturers who have had products delisted, valid third-party referrals, and the new and popular models. And of course, the verification administrative bodies will be responsible for facilitating this panel to select these products. Slide 26 covers a few additional issues related to selecting products for testing. In addition to these factors, we want to make sure that models selected for testing are currently available on the market and can be obtained for testing. To facilitate the process of obtaining products, manufacturers will be required to provide information on where products can be purchased. We do intend on putting a limit on the number of products selected for testing from each manufacturer under this model, allowing flexibility to test more products from manufacturers who have had product failures in previous rounds. In terms of obtaining products for testing described on slide 27, the preferred option is to obtain products from the marketplace. We also are considering other options for products which are not available off the shelf or are prohibitively expensive, such as off-the-line witnessed testing. In comments received to date, we have heard a lot of support for off-the-shelf testing. On slide 28, we discussed the sample size for testing. The current plan is to require the same number of units for testing that is required under the product specifications. In many cases, this is only one unit. During the testing, other specification-related requirements will apply, such as the additional testing triggers that go into place if the test result is within a certain percent of the limits. The example here that we give is for imaging equipment, but of course every specification has its own nuances, and we do not contemplate changing the specifications with this framework, rather using the specification and building off of that as we conduct the verification testing. Finally, on slide 29, we complete our description of the quality assurance testing model with a brief description of partner responsibilities. The partners will be responsible for paying the third-party administrator for testing of selected products. This testing selection will take place either once or twice during the year. I now want to move on to slide 30, where I will move to our last topic for today, the third-party certification and verification testing model. As I mentioned earlier, this model will apply to a range of appliances and products found in buildings as well as component products, such as external power supplies and battery charging systems. We have the full list described on slide 30. I have windows highlighted separately on this slide as these are products that are custom ordered. There are already existing certification requirements for windows in place through the NFRC. It is worth noting that we have received broad support from the window manufacturing community for the NFRC certification program, despite the costs associated with that testing. I will now go through the main aspects of the third-party certification and verification testing approach based on the outline provided on page 31. You will note a similar set of considerations as we discussed for the quality assurance testing model. The main differences are in the program administration and in the challenge testing provisions. I will try to highlight these as we walk through. Slide 32 describes our proposed approach to program administration for third-party testing. In this model, not only will the third-party administer verification testing, but will also administer initial qualification testing, often referred to as certification or certifying the product. Under this model, there could be more than one program administrator since they provide both the upfront and the follow-on testing. The qualifications for these program administrators are similar to those under the quality assurance verification testing model. However, there will be less interaction between EPA, DOE, and these programs in selecting products since this ongoing testing will be so much more comprehensive. Because of the full range of testing services provided by these program administrators, we will want to ensure that they have appropriate quality control measures in place, such as the ISO Guide 65. And EPA would plan to approve programs based on their ability to meet all of the qualification criteria. Their responsibilities would include the selection of appropriate labs, the certification and verification testing, ensuring that the testing remains on schedule, and providing detailed reports and summaries to EPA and DOE. Under this model, qualification testing will ideally be conducted in third-party independent labs with the possible consideration for use of in-house labs. This is on slide 33. And as mentioned earlier, we do plan to continue the discussion with stakeholders around the use of in-house labs for qualification / certification testing. We also want to make sure that products are not tested and certified based on the rating of another product unless the differences do not impact the energy performance, such as the appearance of the product. when the manufacturer has the product certified, they must also provide information on the distribution of the product to facilitate selection of products for verification testing. There are currently a couple of existing lab accreditation requirements in place for products covered under the third-party certification and verification testing model. These are described on slide 34. Last year, we introduced a requirement for vent fans to be certified for purposes of ENERGY STAR, and as part of this requirement, both initial testing and follow-on testing must be conducted by independent third-party labs under formal approved certification programs. We also recently introduced a requirement for commercial refrigerator products to be tested in an approved lab or to have the test data verified prior to ENERGY STAR qualification. We do plan to build on these requirements for a range of products in a way that makes use of existing mechanisms, such as the accreditations under the Standards Council of Canada, and we hope we have addressed some of the comments in this area through that intent. The lab requirements we are considering for third-party verification testing are the same as those for quality assurance testing. We anticipate further discussion on this topic, as I mentioned before. Those are described on slide 35. And then moving to slide 36, this covers the process for selecting products under this model. The main difference between the quality assurance testing model and this model is the number of models selected for testing. So since models must be tested frequently under this model, every 3 years in the case of vent fans, the certification program administrators will be largely responsible for selecting the products with input from EPA, DOE, and other stakeholders as necessary. Slide 37 describes the process for obtaining models off the shelf, which we believe should be the same as the process for obtaining models for quality assurance testing, with them mostly being off the shelf or tested off the line as necessary. Slide 38 is also a bit repetitive of the other model, since we do not feel that the type of model we use for verification testing should necessarily impact the sample size. We believe it is the product specification requirements that should drive the sample size when verifying that products meet the specification. Slide 39 touches on a new element for third-party verification testing. This is the challenge testing requirement. We have received a lot of supporting comments for having challenge testing programs in place. The idea behind challenge testing is that one company can challenge another company if they believe a product does not meet the ENERGY STAR requirements. In this model, the financial burden typically falls on the company that's either at fault, the one whose product fails, or if the product doesn't fail, then the one the company who is accused of this other company of having a failing model. The current testing requirements for vent fans that are in place do include a challenge testing provision. The partner responsibilities under the third-party testing model described on slide 40 will be to participate in a certification program where the verification testing is included in the overall fee. Under this model, testing would occur at least annually. That, for the most part, completes the content I wanted to share with you today. Slide 41 describes the next steps for continuing this discussion. We will have time today for general questions. However, we have a number of calls scheduled over the next 2 weeks, as I mentioned, to discuss these requirements at a product-specific level. We also have a call which will focus only on accreditation bodies, labs, and certification programs, and we hope that you have already registered for all these calls per your specific interests. We will be adding more information about these calls on our website, which you can access at energystar.gov/MOU under the enhanced testing section. And we will also send out call and information to registered participants at least a day in advance. Slide 42 describes our longer term next steps. We request that you send in comments on the slide deck by April 30th. We will have details on how to submit comments on our website. Specifically, we would ask you to submit them to ENERGY STAR Verification Program at energystar.gov. However, that address will be on our website for you to note. We will then distribute draft guidance documents for your review in May. After incorporating your comments, we will work to finalize requirements by July or August. However, please note that while the requirements will be finalized and new partner commitments in place, we do plan to phase in the verification testing requirements in a way that allows adequate time for certification programs to be developed and for lab accreditation to occur. Finally, on the last slide, I have provided you with my contact information as well as my colleague Catherine Kaplan's information if you have additional questions that we do not cover on any of these calls. Catherine may be able to join us later in the Q&A discussion, but is certainly engaged on all of these topics as well. And I think at this point, we'll turn this over to Marvin, our operator, to assist in facilitating a Q&A session for this call, and hopefully we can address as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone to ask a question. Unfortunately, Ms. Kaplan has not joined at this time.
Thank you,
Marvin. Our first question will be from Brian Owen with Green TVIS. Please go ahead.
One-year advance. Could you clarify that point, and does that apply to lighting?
I'm sorry. I could not hear the first part of your question.
I said I was confused, or I may have misinterpreted that Energy Star Partners could label product up to 1 year in advance, I guess, before the actual listing. Can you clarify that? Did I misinterpret that? And if it is the case, would that apply to lighting?
It does not apply to lighting. For lighting products specifically, the products have to be tested before they can be lit and qualified, before they can be labeled. However, for several of the Energy Star products right now, the manufacturers, as long as they've conducted their testing, are allowed to label the products before submitting the data to us. This new set of requirements would not change the story for the lighting partners, but it would be a difference for many of the other products. So it's actually a good question you bring up, because we have a lot of different requirements in place right now for Energy Star products, and requirements that we've put in place over the years as it has made sense. And right now, a lot of this will just be making sure that the requirements across the board are equal for all of our products.
Could I respond with a secondary?
Sure.
Okay. I'm very, excited for what I see in terms of the enhanced testing and verification procedure. And I'm wondering, when it comes to the way you have the third party testing, qualified lab testing, which we use in lighting now, will this all be consistent throughout all the programs and product classifications? Or would there be special exceptions granted to product categories? Or are you hoping that what you're showing today will be sort of the lay of the land and the way all categories must maintain their discipline?
We would like everything to be as consistent as possible in our approach. However, the reason for all of the product-specific calls is to make sure that we're still treating things appropriately on a product basis. So, yes, for the most part, what we've laid out here today is what we would like to see across all Energy Star products. However, I think I noted a few different places in the presentation where we're open to having further discussion on product specific basis to make sure we have all the right considerations in place. And I would just note for lighting that a lot of the requirements we have in place will not really change too much. It's going to stay very similar. We do have a call scheduled to discuss that, I believe, on April 6th, and where we will talk about kind of some tweaks we might want to make and just making the requirements across all lighting products consistent, since even for the lighting products, we have different requirements right now, whether it's CFL or a residential lighting fixture, et cetera.
Well, I mean, there again, I'm very pleased to hear that the philosophy, let's say, is that there would be consistency amongst all the product categories, because what my main concern is that when it comes to looking at what we're seeing right now, especially with respect to solid-state lighting, that I am concerned that market share is taking more of a front seat than quality assurance. And I'm not making that assumption to be negative towards the program. It's just a very, very large concern that I see, and I think a lot of the industry shares. And I just wanted to ask you, how can you assure the latter that quality assurance will be the job one?
Well, I think that for your specific considerations, we should probably discuss those in more details in the lighting call.
Great.
But this is certainly a discussion that I think is valuable to have, not just between you and me, but also within kind of a larger forum where we can have an open discussion. So I do appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question is from Christopher Wold with CLASP. Please go ahead.
Yes. I had a really quick question on this third-party qualification testing. So it sounds like, if I heard you correctly, you're going to possibly allow some manufacturers to do in-house lab testing. And I'm wondering, how is that different from the current system in which manufacturers self-test their products and then submit the results by allowing them to continue to do that? So I'm wondering, how is it an improvement upon the old system if that's still going to be the case? And also, too, are there going to be other kinds of requirements placed on the in-house testing that makes it different than the in-house testing that's done today?
Thank you. A great question. For the in-house lab testing, we would certainly want to look to make sure that those in-house labs have the proper accreditations in place, which is different from, you know, I don't want to say for every product because we have these requirements in place for some products, but for many of the products, we do not say what types of accreditations you need to have for the lab, whether it's in-house or it's third-party. So if we did want to consider allowing in-house labs, we would want to look toward proper accreditations for those laboratories, and we would also want to make sure that we have all the appropriate controls in place for using those laboratories. This is an issue that I think merits a lot of additional discussion if we're going to consider it. And so I would, you know, pretty much in all these product-specific calls that we have in the coming weeks, I've set aside at least some time at the end for discussion purposes to talk about this issue so that we can get as much feedback as possible for folks.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Our next question is from Bruce Hochschild with Nebraska Energy Office. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Kathleen, this is I saw a lot on the testing, but I didn't see anything on enforcement. Do you have anything in place to deter the manufacturers from just going ahead and slapping the label on, falsifying their tests? What happens to them other than just, you know, you got to remove the label?
Yes, and I suppose your question would refer to our partners if they just went and used the label without us, without going through all the testing. As I mentioned at the very upfront part of this call, we have partnership agreements with our partners that they will use the logo and the label according to our terms and conditions, and violating any of those terms and conditions would be a breach of our partnership agreements. Could result in termination of the partnership, and so it is taken seriously. A follow-on question from you, maybe, or maybe even embedded in your question, is how would we know whether people are doing this or not?
Well, I'm more concerned with the fact that there aren't any fines that can be imposed. There, you know, the whole reason that a company wants to use the Energy Star logo is to increase sales. I mean, people are aware of energy right now. And I think your only deterrent is to come back with some type of a fine to just say, well, you can't use it anymore. Well, shoot, I got the goodie out of it I could and didn't cost me anything. I think that's the mentality that's out there now. Not everywhere, but for those that are abusing the logo and the rating system.
Well, I certainly appreciate that comment, and we would like to make sure part of the reason for communicating testing results or information about the mislabeled products is to do exactly what you're saying, which is to make sure that we get information out into the marketplace if there are products that shouldn't be qualified that are. And so, I appreciate your comments on the fines or other mechanisms that we could use for this. We are thinking about what's most effective here, because we realize as we place additional requirements on our partners that if there's a lot of effort that goes into that, and we don't want to punish those people who are doing things correctly. So, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ray Garys with Geldwin. Please go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As you know, we have a lot of questions about the window and door parts of this thing, because we have tens of millions of products that are already in the NFRC system. But I have a question on slide number 36.
Which slide is that? 36. Okay.
The second point on 36 says must test all certified products at least every 3 years. Now that has far-reaching implications for window and door business. We've been in a four-year cycle for 30 years. And I'm curious where you came up with the 3 years, and is our existing four-year program going to be acceptable?
Thank you, Ray, for that question. The three-year is a standard model that we used for the Ventham program, just to answer that aspect of your question. However, earlier in the presentation, I think when I was going through what was covered under the third-party certification model, I noted that the windows, since they were a different type of product, we were going to discuss them separately and use a slightly different model. And really, we plan to largely use what's already in place for through the NFRC. And so I would not, for the windows aspect, I would not see that, you know, you're held exactly to this process that we've described here. The NFRC process is a bit different, and I think we recognize that on slide 30. So, you know, we do have a call scheduled on Wednesday, March 31st, to talk about windows. I hope you're able to participate in that call. And in that call, we will be talking about how the NFRC program meets all of the goals that we have here in this model, and have a great discussion around if and any changes we think are needed to make sure that that model is consistent with this overall goals of what we discussed here today.
Okay, so your intent is to use many of the things that are in our existing National Fenestration Rating Council program that we use.
Yes, sir.
Great. Thanks for answering the question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Thomas Jones with Brocade. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. In your presentation, you mentioned IT and office equipment. As this thing develops further, is there going to be a more specific definition of what types of products will be covered under Energy Star? I'm specifically interested in the enterprise servers, enterprise storage, and the small network equipment. Is that going to include every piece of equipment that touches the servers and storage, or every piece that is connected to the servers and storage? And then for small network equipment, is there going to be a better definition for that? Also, currently, there's a Japanese energy efficiency law called Top Runner. Is the testing going to align in any way with any of the other global standards?
Thank you. To answer the first part of your question, the products that we plan to include and cover under the consumer electronics and IT equipment portion of this are described completely on the schedule we have posted on our website of all the product-specific calls. So I can read those quickly to you. It's the AV equipment, computers, data center storage, decorative light strings, DTA, digital to analog converter boxes, displays, imaging equipment, servers, set-top boxes, small network equipment, telephony, televisions, and uninterruptible power supplies. Please note, we're not describing what products are included through this. That's specified directly through the specification. So the small network equipment specification, which is currently under development, what products are covered under that specification will be determined through that process, not through this process. And the same for all of the other ones. We won't be determining what products are covered. That's already decided by the specification requirements. So hopefully that answers that part of the question. And then the second part was about international programs and how we plan to work with them. We do have international agreements on Energy Star with a number of our international partners, and as part of this program, we plan to reach out to them and work with them so that we can share testing information, and hopefully there's, you know, to the extent that there's any testing happening outside the U.S., there can be data that's shared with us as well. In terms of alignment of our product specifications and our testing requirements, we do look to align to the extent possible, especially in terms of test procedure harmonization. We look to align at a product specification level. To the extent that the requirements are the same across products, then that test data would be applicable for folks around the world.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from Jeffrey Blank with SR Products. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I do have a question, but I also would like to respond to the esteemed colleague from the Nebraska Energy Department, and I feel it's incumbent upon me as a Energy Star stakeholder for over 10 years. Sir, we are very proud of our Energy Star certification. Believe me, if any of our competitors got wind that we had been delisted, that would be a huge, huge negative fallout for us from a marketing perspective and would be catastrophic. So your desire to have additional fines or other punitive actions, I think, would be extraordinarily counterproductive. And if you really don't believe that, then I think you should talk to the people at Toyota. Having said that, I have a question on slide 39 with regards to the challenge testing.
Mm-hmm.
What would be – are there going to be management tools in place with regards to this process from the Department of Energy?
I'm sorry, when you say management tools, what do you mean by that?
Well, specifically, what would prevent a Goliath-type competitor from constantly challenging a David-like competitor? What would restrict them from doing that?
I guess the way that we're looking at it, you would have this third-party entity, this certification program that would facilitate the challenge testing. So if you have somebody who's challenging your product and they're having it testing, if they want to pay to have that other product tested, then they're going to have to pay for it. As long as it meets the requirements, then whoever is being tested will not have to pay anything.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay.
So essentially when you say challenge testing, let's say I'm Goliath manufacturer. I could, let's say, go into the market. Well, I could have an independent third-party testing lab go out and take something off the shelf and test it, correct?
Correct. You would have to go through this third-party certification program to do that. You couldn't just have a third-party lab randomly go out and select a whole bunch of products for testing.
Right.
But, yeah.
So, but there would be no responsibility to the challenged company with regards to – they wouldn't even – theoretically, they wouldn't even know they had been challenged, correct?
I think that the goal would be for them to know that they were challenged through this process and for there to be some sort of valid reason for challenging them. I don't think the idea is for people to just go out and blanketly challenge the industry to say,
yes,
we want to test everything.
I understand, but
yes.
from our perspective, the kind of products that we're involved in, it's not a big deal to go and buy something off the shelf and send it to somebody's lab and have it tested. But the key thing here for us would be what kind of responsibility would there be for the challenged company initially, and you're saying there really isn't anything. I mean, they just would the third-party testing company would send a bill to the challenger, correct?
Right. Well, I think the way that we're envisioning it, the third-party, it's not even a testing company, but the third-party certification program itself that was running the testing and administering the testing, that manufacturer would have to approach them and say, I want to challenge these products to testing. The third-party certification program would then have to work with them to say, okay, why do you want to challenge this? What do you think is wrong with this? And then if there seemed to be a valid reason for challenging it, then that certification program would work with their selected laboratories to go and obtain the product from the marketplace and to test the product. And as part of that exchange, would let this company who's being challenged know that they're being challenged and see if they accepted the challenge. so that manufacturer could say, well, sure, of course my product meets Energy Star. Go ahead and test it and pay for it. That's fine. So that's really the idea behind it. And in the case that you have a manufacturer whose product perhaps it doesn't meet Energy Star and something's happened, well, maybe they don't know that and they accept the challenge, or maybe they know that and they say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to be challenged here. So
right.
You could see that there's a number of different situations that could arise in this type of situation. But the idea is to have a mechanism in place, a formal mechanism in place for these test results to be actually conducted in a fair way.
You could see, though, how that could be, if not properly managed, abused.
Well, so perhaps I think the best thing to do is to continue this discussion, perhaps even in the call with the labs and accreditation bodies and certification programs, to talk about this issue further to see what kind of controls we would want to put in place around such a challenge program requirement to make sure we didn't have that abuse.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes.
And our next question is from Ralph Hudnall with EuroPro. Please go ahead.
A couple of comments and then a couple of questions. Just want to clarify, comments for this presentation are due back to you by April 30th. Is that correct?
They're due to Energy Star verification program at EPA at energystar.gov.
Okay.
By April 30th. And I mean, I will see all of them, but that's the mailbox we're using for compiling all the comments.
Okay.
And we'll have that email address that will be posted on our website, hopefully later on today or Monday.
Cool. Secondly, I'm all for in-house testing. We have every confidence we could meet the requirements, but anything I can do to meet the requirements and lessen my costs and speed my time to market is a plus for me as a manufacturer. So anything I'll be discussing this more on the specific calls, but I just want to put that out there that I, for one, am all for any in-house testing we can do with the proper controls, and that's completely understood. If it's good enough for safety for Intertech or UL to come to my lab or even let me do the lab testing and report the data to them, I think it should be good enough for efficiency, but that's enough on that one. Specific questions. Slide 8. Who would notify me as the partner of my unit passing or failing? Would that be Energy Star or the third party?
Sorry, I'm just trying to go to slide 8 right now. So could you repeat that question one more time, please?
Who is responsible to notify me of, well, start with say the product passes the requirements. Who notifies me, the partner, Energy Star or the third party?
This is for the qualification testing or for verification testing?
We'll start with qualification.
Okay, so for qualification testing, you would work with the approved, accredited laboratory to have the product tested, and then I would assume the lab would let you know that this product passes, and then you would instruct the lab to send that test information on to EPA. The goal here would not be for a lab to be sending information to EPA for products that don't meet the requirements. So that there is some sort of, for qualification purposes, there's a kind of a back and forth between a manufacturer and a lab to do the testing in the first place, and then for the manufacturer to, you know, direct the lab that, okay, if it qualifies, I want the data to be sent over to EPA. I want to qualify my product. So does that make sense?
Yeah. The flow chart looks like I'd be notified at the very end, and it doesn't really matter. Well, it does matter because I've got to communicate to my factory, yes, we're Energy Star, put the mark on, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yes. No, fair enough. So I think the idea here is that you have the product tested in the laboratory. As a manufacturer, you have it tested. Then you, as a manufacturer, and these are some details and nuances that we need to make sure are covered in all the instructions, but
yep.
You, as a manufacturer, would need to provide at least basic information to EPA that you want to qualify this product because you're the partner of EPA, right? So you need to provide information that this product will qualify, this is what I want to be on the Energy Star list. So you send that information to us. In addition to that, the lab has to send information to EPA to confirm that it's been tested in this approved lab. Once we checked off those two, then we make sure the submission meets the requirements, and the product to our list of qualified products and let you know that, okay, it's done. You're all qualified.
Okay. For delisting a product, would the product become delisted before I'm notified? In other words, would I have a chance to say, oh, wait, maybe the product was damaged in shipping, or maybe I have, maybe there's something I can do to fix it, or maybe possibly you got the 1 out of 3 million that I made that is defective, but there's 2,999,000 that are good. Would I have a chance to react to the failed test? This is on verification. Would I have a chance to react to the failed test before the product is delisted?
Yes, the idea behind verification testing is that the process we have in place with the labs conducting the verification testing, there would be a process for making sure that the model is quote unquote deemed a failure. So if we deem the model a failure, it's because of more than, you know, there's a product that fails the test result, but then, you know, there's us needing to make that ultimate call that model has failed and it will be delisted. So we do plan to build in into each of those testing processes a kind of a back and forth dialogue with manufacturers where you would be able to make sure that model actually failed.
Right. That's all I asked. last question, and I forget what it was. There was something on your website that EPA would post failed products. Is that failed products that on verification testing or products that I may have submitted for qualification didn't make the requirements?
Certainly not that. We would ask that you don't submit products for qualification if they don't meet the requirements, but they would never get through the process to be on our list in the first place, the way we're looking at the model right now.
Okay.
So therefore there would be no process for delisting. In terms of the models that would be listed on our website as delisted would be those models that we had deemed to be failures.
Right.
We had communicated that to the manufacturer and then take action to get them off the list. And then, of course, there's a need to let people know who thought maybe that product was Energy Star that model's been delisted. And there's, you know, in the case that has to happen, which is unfortunate, and we would like to, you know, the purpose of this is to put as many controls in place as possible so you avoid that to the largest extent possible. But in the case that we do need to do that, then there's a series of corrective action plans and enforcement actions we have to go through with our partner.
Okay. I think
yep.
That'll do it for me. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Mark Forrester with DataCard Group. Please go ahead.
Well, my question's already been answered here. Somebody else had already touched on it, so... someone else can go.
Thank you. And if you find your question has already been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing *2. Our next question is from Homi Ahmadi with Extron Electronics. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I have three very brief questions. Number one was you did not mention anything about professional audio-video equipment on the list of the products on slide 18. Question number two was, what about if the manufacturer has its own 17025 accreditation? Do we still have to go through a third-party NRTL lab? And the last part of the question is, will there be any matrix or schedule of various conference calls that you're planning between now and May, like the lighting, the windows, the IT, and so forth? So where would I be able to find such a matrix or a schedule of all these discussions?
Yes. Let me answer those three questions. The first one was professional audio-video products. All of the consumer electronics, the IT, the office equipment, and also audio-video products would be included in that set of products as well. Those are all grouped together, and we have the details on kind of the calls and what products are covered on a PDF that we send out in the email with the call information. You can also access that schedule of calls on our website, energystar.gov/MOU. At the bottom of that page, there's a link that has a PDF with all of the conference calls we're planning over the next 2 weeks. Then, with respect to your question about the use of in-house labs that have 17025. This is one of the topics that we need to continue discussing on our product-specific calls, whether or not that would be appropriate either for qualification and if for verification to, you know, in what way would you be able to use in-house labs with that accreditation and still have a valid verification of the product. So that's for your question there is not set in stone. It's up for further discussion. And I think that answers it all, if it answers it for you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question is from Deborah Brunk with the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Deborah.
I had two questions for you. First of all, I wanted to thank you for a good overview. I think a lot of details were addressed in this overview presentation. The first question I have is regarding a qualification sample, say, versus a verification sample. And if for a number of products you mentioned there may only be one sample that is required for testing for qualification, which would imply that you might test one sample for verification. Have you looked at any kind of tolerance requirements or anything along those lines in regards to whether that verification sample would say pass or fail? I'm thinking of if you have a product that, you know, is maybe rated or qualified at, say, 300 kilowatt hours per year and the lab measures 303 kilowatt hours per year, what does that mean for that product?
Okay, let me answer that one first. So in terms of the samples, we are looking at the same sample size as we have in the specific product, you know, the product specification. And so in terms of tolerances, the tolerances that we would allow in the verification testing are the same that are in the product specification. So, as long as the product is meeting the Energy Star requirements, which is what they need to do, they would not fail. However, you do bring up a good point, which is if they're rated at a certain level and they're way off that level, even if they're still meeting Energy Star, it's not providing very good information to the consumer about how much that product consumes. So to the extent possible, we would like to have all of those tolerance requirements written into the specifications themselves. And we would likely, in the case that a product failed to meet those tolerance requirements but still passed Energy Star, we would discuss a different set of corrective actions than you know, taking off the label. It would instead be trying to correct information about the energy consumption of the model. And this is kind of another point that I try to hit on a little bit in the presentation, which is that, you know, if there are changes to a model that result in changes in energy consumption, even if both of those meet the Energy Star requirements, we would want that new data on that model to make sure we have the current information on consumption of that model. So does that answer your question?
Yes, and I think we can get into that in more detail in our product-specific discussion. Thank you.
Okay.
And then my second question was if you could just help me a little bit. I am still a little bit confused in your discussion of the market-based testing versus the DOE testing, and if you could just review that once more for me again, I would appreciate it. I don't quite understand the differences, except for, I guess, I'm assuming the market-based, is that more just Energy Star specific, or?
So, yes, definitely. So all of the requirements that I discussed here today are the market-based testing requirements.
Right.
These are testing requirements for our Energy Star partners who are required as part of being an Energy Star partner to go out and use market, you know, testing programs in the marketplace for conducting their testing based on this set of requirements that we lay out through this process. I mentioned the DOE testing up front because it's another element of what we're doing at DOE and EPA to make sure that the Energy Star mark is being used correctly. I did not go into any details on the DOE testing because right now that process is not up for discussion. It's a government program that DOE is running where they're going through and they're pulling products off shelves and testing them to make sure that they meet Energy Star, and it's a program that just got up and running recently, and it'll be running for, they're testing products right now, and to the extent that we get information and feedback from that, we can use that to take actions as well, but it's we haven't discussed it here because it's not something that we're developing. It's something that's being developed internally. So I guess it's, and also just to clarify, it's meant as a complementary program to this. So they work together. Even with all of these market-based testing programs, DOE and EPA both reserve the right to continue to do any kind of verification testing deemed necessary. And so this DOE program is a way of going out and getting started on that right now.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from Michael Christian with Technicolor. Please go ahead.
Yes, on slide 12, the subpoints under the first bullet, specifically products qualified before X date will need to be requalified after Y date. Just wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. And I'm thinking in terms of like consumer electronics where, okay, we have a certain model of something. We might make a million of them in a three-month period. Then we make no more of them ever again. And so how does that type of product fit into your intent here?
Right. So, I mean, that's part of the discussion. So I guess if the products are qualified before this date, when this new requirement goes into place, this X date, so these would be your products where you have millions of them and they're out on shelves and they are being sold and there's no more of them being tested. So the idea behind this is that you would need to requalify these products after a certain date. So, you know, maybe it's a year from them, maybe it's 6 months from them. We have to determine what the right date is depending on the product and its length in the market and talk through some of these issues to determine that right Y date. But the idea is that you would allow a reasonable time for products to be retested. So that if you knew that product was going to continue to be out in the marketplace after this Y date, you would have the opportunity to test it. And if you knew that it was going to be gone after Y date and not in the market anymore, then it would just come off the list and would no longer need to be on Energy Star because it would no longer be available in the marketplace.
Okay, so your list of things that are essentially on your website, are they just for product that is currently in the market, or I guess your statement there saying that it would come off the list, what list do you mean?
Well, we do have our manufacturing partners update. They're responsible for updating their list of products that are, you know, when they're going to be available and when they're going to, you know, when they're no longer manufactured, when they're no longer available in the marketplace. And so we do adjust the way that things show up in our list of qualifying products based on that information that's provided. And so what we would want to do is to decide that, in this case, we would want to make a note if that product's no longer available in the marketplace, you know, it would still be maintained in our system for historical purposes, but we would need to have a discussion to decide whether or not that, you know, we would likely want that product to come off of our list. And in the case that, you know, somebody has a product they bought 5 years ago that was Energy Star, if they look on our list today, it's very likely they're not going to see that product because it's no longer out in the marketplace, especially if it's, you know, a CE-type product that has a really quick turnaround time. But we do have the ability to go into our system and to see if that product was qualified at that time. So I think it's worth, you know, us exploring a little bit more how this will be rolled out in terms of how it's listed on the QP list. But in general, our intent is that if you have things in the marketplace after a certain date, that they will have had this testing.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question is from Doug Leonard with Laboratory Accreditation Bureau. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. LAB, we're a third-party accreditor recognized under the ILAC and MRA and recognized by NACLA. Under the just a tad bit confused on the slides, slide number 22, under the current programs, we would meet, of course, the first qualification testing requirements to accredit labs to that program, but I'm wondering under the verification system, would we meet those requirements? We're not NAVLAB. NAVLAB's part of NIST. So how does that, under the current program, would we be qualified to accredit those laboratories, I guess is the question.
Thank you. Yes. In fact, this is one of the areas where we are planning to have further discussion for lighting products specifically. Right now, we do have some inconsistencies in our program with respect to the accreditation requirements for qualification versus verification testing and whether it needs to be a NAVLAB accredited lab or it can be one of these labs that's, you know, accredited by a signatory to the one of the ILAC members. And so we are aware of this discrepancy. The reason it was put in place this way in the first place is to make sure that only those labs who had experience doing the testing were allowed to do this. However, we do recognize a need and to have this process open, and so that we can spell out the specific requirements of an accreditation body to make sure that a lab can do the testing appropriately. This is one of the things we hope to accomplish, and one of the, you know, we don't have a lot of changes we're contemplating to the way the lighting testing is conducted, but this is one of them. And so I would encourage you to, if you're interested in lighting testing specifically, or even, you know, kind of general testing, we'll likely hit on this topic on both our call with accreditation bodies, labs, and certification programs, and our call on lighting.
Yeah, and again, I think this, the new way you're proceeding is great. Many CPSC, and there's been a lot of success stories heading down this path. So, again, we support that wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Steve Jordanoff with Jaff Tech Manufacturing Limited. Please go ahead.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hello.
Actually, I have three things. You know, we go through the qualification process, which we have, and that allows us to, you know, promote the product as an Energy Star qualified product. Now, I've also heard product, and I'm referring, I guess, to lighting here, but I've also heard product called Energy Star rated. Now, is there a difference between being Energy Star qualified and being Energy Star rated?
The term Energy Star rated is actually not an allowed term. It's supposed to be called Energy Star qualified.
Okay. Now, we've had the product qualified based on tests. Now, what happens if we make a change to the product, which will not impact, you know, the tests that were to be conducted, nor it doesn't impact the energy savings or the performance of the product? Do we need to then notify someone of that change? And if so, who?
So the way we're looking at it, to the extent that changes do not impact the energy consumption of the product that's been tested, then you would not need to make any notifications or any changes. But you would want to be sure that those changes did not impact. You know, if you're talking about making it blue instead of red, then obviously that's not going to impact energy consumption. If you're talking about switching out components of sorts, then you want to be sure that it's not going to impact the energy consumption, and if it doesn't, then there's no need to report anything.
Oh, okay. But if you did want to, and just confirm, I guess, that the change wouldn't, you know, be any impact, that who would you contact?
So right now, if you qualify your product through Energy Star and then you're contemplating making a change to that product, so that's still Energy Star but has a different level, we would likely want to enter into a discussion with you to make sure that it was still appropriate to call it the same product model number. The last thing you want is to have confusion out in the marketplace where a consumer has, you know, two consumers have the same model and they have different energy consumption. What are they supposed to look at? How, you know, even if they both meet Energy Star, what level should they be looking at? So depending on the extent of the change, we would want to discuss whether it was appropriate to have a different product model number for that product.
Okay, good. No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question is from Bill Shield with Gulf Coast Fan and Light. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. It's in relation to ceiling fans. I know that they are categorized under lighting, and I was just curious on the new upcoming regulations for the
Uh-oh, I'm sorry. I think you may have cut out, Bill.
Please pick up your handset or unmute your line at this time.
Bill, are you still there?
It looks like we've lost Mr. Scheel. We'll move on to the next question. Our next question is from Brett Serene with Electronics for Imaging Incorporated. Please go ahead.
Hello. In some of the ENERGY STAR specifications, one of the major components is the power supply itself, whether it meets 80-plus bronze or something like that. Given that, or an external power supply that falls under separate specification, given that this is the main component that is actually being measured for ENERGY STAR, do you have some mechanism on how to deal with these type of things, since the same power supply can end up in multiple products? So instead of having to keep submitting every single product for submission and verification, do we submit a representative product that contains the certified power supply?
So are you referring to an end-use product that contains a power supply, or talking about actually qualifying a power supply?
The end-use product. Because, for example, under imaging equipment DFEs, the only thing that the DFE is required to have is a certified power supply, whether it be an external or internal power supply. So each of these products then ships with one of these power supplies. Do we have to test every single product and submit every single product, or show that a representative product containing the power supply meets, and then therefore every product that contains that power supply meets, if that's the only ENERGY STAR requirement?
Yes, I know this issue is a little bit confusing for end-use, or it's complicated for the end-use products because of the way the external power supplies are switched out within the same product model number. And we are planning to have a discussion about this on the call that we have scheduled for external power supplies and battery charging products. And I think this is a detail that we need to work out further. So I would encourage, I will make a note of this, and I would encourage you to participate in that call so we can discuss this specifically and figure out what is the best way to approach it.
By the way, it also applies to internal power supplies and computer systems. So
okay.
So you got to look for both of them, not just external.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It looks like Mr. Scheel has re-queued, so we'll go back to Mr. Scheel with Gulf Coast Fan and Light. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, I'm sorry. I got disconnected. I was talking about the ceiling fan light kit requirements, and I understand that there are going to be changes for those requirements. Are all ceiling fan light kits going to be ENERGY STAR rated, required in the future? And what would the timetable for that be?
I don't actually know the details on ceiling fan the requirements for ceiling fans and federal standards associated with that, which I believe is what you're referring to. So I would, you know, urge you to, you're welcome to send me a note, and I'm happy to direct you to the right person in our team who manages ceiling fans and can help with that. The actual requirements of product specifications are not contemplated within the scheme we're describing here. We're just talking about how to carry out the requirements that are already in place. So to the extent that you have questions about ceiling fans or that other people have questions about products and they don't know who to get in touch with, we do have some information on our website, but I'm also happy to direct you to the right person.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And our next question is from Maureen McNamara with the EPA. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is just a comment from a prior question related to whether the government could levy fines against folks who violated, or whether EPA would take on fines. And I just wanted to remind folks that ENERGY STAR is a registered trademark, and it's protected by U.S. trademark law. so that, you know, the court systems really would determine if we ever got to that stage, you know, what fines would be levied. That's all.
Thanks for adding that, Maureen.
Sure.
Our next question is from Mike Buzzard with A2LA. Please go ahead.
Hi there, Kathleen. We had a quick question back on slide 8 about the qualification and the test data from the accredited labs. We're kind of curious why the laboratory would be sending the test report just to the EPA rather than back to their customer, so to speak, who would be that manufacturer.
This process is intended to show how the product gets on to the Energy Star, to the Energy Star qualifying product list. So certainly there will be additional back and forth other than this between manufacturers and labs, and you know, the manufacturer is the one who engages with the lab in the first place to have their product tested. So we assume that type of interaction is happening in the background. This diagram is really just trying to show how the product ends up on our list.
Yeah, we were just kind of assuming logistically it would be much more simple for the manufacturer to go to the lab, ask the lab to test, laboratory tests the product, sends their reports, and A2LA is one of the ILAC MRA accreditation bodies. And so we require all our lab test reports to be endorsed with our symbol saying A2LA accredited.
Yes.
And that would kind of give EPA, reassurance that nothing strange would have happened and it's not a bogus report, but we think that logistically sending the report back to the manufacturer would be easier for everybody involved, because that way EPA, when you guys get a test report from one person and, you know, maybe even 2 weeks later, that application from the manufacturer, if everything came from the manufacturer at once, it might just be easier.
Okay, yeah, we can certainly consider that to see if that makes sense. One of the goals of having the labs send the information to EPA rather than having everything come from a manufacturer is so that you would just have that one extra assurance step up front that data did come from that lab and there's no way that, you know, things could be falsified. So that was the reason for having that in place, but we're certainly open to looking at other mechanisms for the process flow to happen in a way where all the assurances would be in place.
That just sounds like something that we would talk to you about on the accreditation body's phone call next week in terms of the accredited test reports that we require our labs to put out.
Yes, thank you. No, I agree. That would be a good discussion topic for that call.
All right. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Ken Knudsen with SubZero Incorporated. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. We're represented by an industry association that's implementing a verification test program. And I'm wondering if this industry program will take the place of the DOE EPA verification testing.
When you say the DOE EPA verification testing, I would note that we have two different approaches we're using, and we're planning to use both of them. There's the DOE testing that I talked about, that's the government testing program, and there's this DOE EPA market-based testing program, and we plan on both of those taking place. If there's an existing industry certification program in place through the market-based testing program, to the extent that those programs meet our requirements and meet the intent of what we're trying to do, we are certainly hoping to leverage those to the extent possible. So that is one of the discussion topics. You know, to the extent I'm aware of these types of programs, I'm planning to discuss those further on these product-specific calls so we have a chance to talk about what it is we want to require across Energy Star, how those programs fit into that construct, and whether they meet all the requirements or if there are certain elements that are missing from those programs that would need to be filled in for them to meet this requirement.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Our next question is from Alex Stern with Lockheed Martin. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question is about the challenge testing, and I was wondering if the energy efficiency program sponsors could be the challengers, and if that's the case, is there any way to devise a system where the energy efficiency program sponsors would not have to pay for that testing, being that a lot of money from these programs already flows to the manufacturers, And when energy efficiency programs are concerned with the quality of the product, to have to kind of pony up the money for this testing when a lot of money already goes to incentivize these products, is kind of difficult to come by.
Certainly. So I think that what you're describing, rather than falling under this challenge testing program we described, would more likely fall under the way that we select products for testing under either model. So as I described under the quality assurance testing model, we would have a panel of folks who would select products for testing, and some of that would be based on, just trying to get a wide range of products represented for testing. And part of that would be to see if there was a valid reason that we needed to include a model in this selection of models for testing. There would be an opportunity for the folks on that panel to weigh in, to recommend that, to figure out if it made sense to include that model in the testing. Likewise, in the certification programs, while the certification programs will be responsible for selecting the products, there we do anticipate an exchange of information between the government and those programs and perhaps, with others. If there's each partners who have evidence or have a valid concern about a product, we would certainly want to bring that to their attention. So I think it's through that vehicle that we would want to have products tested if we wanted to, to add them to the testing, rather than the challenge testing program, which is really intended to be a place for manufacturers. I mean, it could be an EAPS, but, for people who are challenging to have that, not just be able to challenge any program in the product, and then they have to pay for the testing because of that one challenge. Regardless of if they fail or not, that I don't think would be the appropriate mechanism for that. But we're open to other ideas on how to best test those products in a way that is fair to all the parties involved.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jonathan Burt with Phillips Lighting. Please go ahead.
Good morning. My question is in regards to getting a lighting fixture qualified.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to submit a product that can be grandfathered in on the LM80 testing. For the sake of time, can I submit my application with this product and then follow up with the LM80 testing at a later date?
Is this question under the current requirements or under these under new requirements? Or
I suppose it would be current requirements.
So under the current requirements, I don't know every single nuance of the lighting requirements right now, so I would read through the existing requirements to see what's allowed. And if it's not clear in there, you can reach out to the folks who are lighting experts on our website. And if you can't find the answer, you can ask me and I'll direct you to the right person.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from John Hill with Keystone Certifications. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for letting me in. I have an accreditation question. I noticed that throughout the slides we referred to the laboratories being accredited to the ISO 17025 document. On slide 32, when we talk about the program administration, there is no reference to accreditation of those bodies. We do reference the Guide 65 document, but we don't say anything about those bodies being accredited to that document. Is that intentional, or is that just an oversight?
I think it's intentional because it's still up for discussion. If we think that for certain product categories it's absolutely necessary for those program administrators to have that accreditation in place, we will certainly consider that. But right now we're looking at just making sure that those programs meet all the intent of having all the quality control measures in place. So maybe they do that through another venue as well. So I think that, we don't, right now we haven't put forth that we would require accreditation for those programs to try to be flexible and how they approach it, but if there's if that's not possible, or you know, if people think that that there have to be accreditations in place and can describe why they have to be in place, then you know, we're open to that continued discussion as well.
And maybe that discussion will be held on Monday at the certification body meeting.
Yes, I think that would be a good time to talk about it in more detail.
Okay, good. Thanks. I do have a second question. Is it your intent that the laboratories and the administrators or the verification testing program people are the same entity, or would they be separate?
This is under the program administration?
Yes.
So the question is whether the program administrators and the labs would be the same?
Yes.
Okay. The way we're looking at it right now, we are thinking that those would be two separate entities. You would have an oversight entity that would make use of different labs to do the testing. However, there could be situations where the best person to do the program administration also happens to be a lab or a large set of laboratories. It really depends on the model. So I think it could be either one, depending on if they have met all the right qualifications. But likely, it would not be the actual laboratory itself doing all the administration of the testing.
All right. Thank you. I'll look forward to the meeting on Monday then.
Okay. Thanks.
Our next question is from Stephen Altamura with Seasonal Specialties. Please go ahead.
Hi, Kathleen. My question is in regards to categories. Basically, decorative lighting strings is under the consumer electronics end of things versus lighting, where on the website it was always lumped under lighting. I was just wondering why decorative lighting strings have been moved into consumer electronics and IT equipment.
Yeah, the reason that we put them in there for purposes of the verification and qualification testing approach is we thought that model was more appropriate for those types of product categories rather than to say that it's not a lighting product. So on the web page, the way we have products grouped is really targeted at a consumer and how they would look for a product. And so we do have the decorative light strings categorized under lighting, but our thought is that we would use we wouldn't necessarily use the exact requirements for lighting for the decorative light strings, just in terms of since we're not contemplating including them in the integrated lighting proposal that we're pursuing as a separate activity. And so for that reason, we lumped them under the consumer electronics and IT equipment. However, I would think that at the end of the day, the requirements would be pretty similar.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from David DeVore with Lexmark International. Please go ahead.
Hi, Kathleen. This is actually Chris Saunders. I'm in here with David DeVore. I have three questions. The first one regarded the phrase that's used for qualification of products, where it says that the product, when qualified, is put on the Energy Star list. And so my question is that the public list? And my concern is, in order to allow for the products that are shippable to customers to be compliant and actually have the logo on the product, that has to start 3 to 4 months prior to the public disclosure of the product. So we run into a situation where, at least in the IT industry, you know, there would be very early premature public disclosure of key attributes of the product in order to be compliant with the logo requirements.
Right. I believe that there's a way right now to qualify products so you can indicate when they're going to be available on the marketplace. And if they're not available on the market, then they wouldn't show up on our public qualifying product list. However, we would have them.
I agree that feature's there, but it doesn't work today.
Okay. To the extent that things aren't working today and aren't in place, I'm happy to go back and address that from an administrative perspective. Yeah.
But the intention is to have a mechanism where that information could be submitted and approved without it being publicly disclosed until this announcement date.
Yes.
Okay. A second question goes back to the verification. And for IT products and some consumer electronics, those products have multiple voltages. Are you assuming that the verification would be done on the U.S. voltage or on all applicable voltages and models?
Right now, we're assuming that the verification would be done for the products that are sold in the U.S. However, to the extent that, you know, we had verification testing happening in other countries at different voltages, we would certainly look to that as well. However, that is the current approach we're contemplating.
Okay, thank you. The third question has to do with 17025, and kind of reading the slides, it appears that the verification entities would use ISO 17025, and I don't know how much you understand or have seen that standard, but there is a uncertainty analysis that has to be done on the measurements and the calculations that currently is not incorporated in the product specifications, at least for IT and consumer electronics. The margin requirements are not scientific and really would not be sufficient to be compliant with 17025. Now, obviously, that can be done lab to lab, but do you envision any sort of kind of across-the-board rules on that testing so that all the verification entities are operating by the same rules, or do you anticipate that that's going to be left up to the different verification third-party labs?
Well, I think we want to put the rules in place so that everybody's doing everything the same way. So to the extent that we need to not only reference 17025, but provide further clarifications beyond that to make sure everything's being done the same way, we would fully intend to do that. So to the extent that we can get further information, especially on specific products, where, you know, the reference to the 17025 is not sufficient, then, you know, we would certainly want to try to incorporate that into our requirements. And then I guess the other thing to note here is that if we have things in our product requirements that we don't think are compatible with the way we're doing the verification testing, we will want to make note of those, so that if it makes sense to go and revisit things within the product specification, we can do so in that venue. I do recognize that in some cases things may not line up exactly, but we need to make note of those and figure out where those are and figure out if it's really the verification testing approach that needs to change or if it's the product specification itself that would need to change.
Just as a comment to that, I think the issue is not with ISO 17025. I've run a lab with 17025. I've designed quality systems to go with 17025, and I'm firmly behind that standard. I really think it does make you a better lab. I think the issue is primarily with the product requirement documents as written today. So thank you.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Chuck Anderson with AAMA. Please go ahead.
Kathleen, I understand the questions you're taking here are broad-based, and we'll be covering the details in the individual product-type calls. And my question really is about that call. I got the presentation yesterday at 6:01 p.m. I'm not sure if there was another copy that was sent out. But that is the only email I received with the presentation in it. When you go to the website and you look at the link where you register for those individual calls, like the window call is the one that I'm interested in. AAMA is the American Architectural Manufacturers Association. We're a trade association for the window industry. We're the largest, well over 300 members. We're also an inspection agency for NFRC, and we're the largest of those also. The deadline for signing up for that call was 5 o'clock yesterday. I have tried to sign up for it. I don't know if it took or not. I have no way of knowing, but I would think we probably need to look at extending those deadlines. Close of business yesterday probably doesn't help a lot of people that learned of that on this call. And then the second thing about that is the timing of the Windows call on March 31st actually lands on top of a Southeast AMA meeting. I'd like somebody that's involved with that call to give me a call tomorrow, and, you know, I'll talk to some people on this end, and we'll see what we can do to resolve that. But obviously, if you're looking for stakeholder feedback, you need to avoid you know, that kind of meeting conflict. And we'll work with you to see, you know, what we can do on our end as well. But so who would be the person that would call me tomorrow to talk about that?
Tomorrow, I don't think you want to call, but maybe you do since it's Saturday.
I would take a call on Saturday, but maybe it's after this meeting. Maybe someone calls me this afternoon, and maybe that's better.
Okay, my schedule is completely booked till the end of the day. I can try calling you at the end of the day if you're there to talk to you about it. And scheduling the meeting. However, we do note that we have, I think, nearly 200 people registered for that webinar. So I would hate to disturb everybody's schedules. We do recognize that there's a lot of schedules to consider here. And if there's people who are not able to participate in calls when we schedule them, we will try to make, you know, just have an additional conversation. We will have materials posted on our website for people to look at, and we will make time to talk to you about your considerations. But, you know, we are trying our best to accommodate everybody here with all of these many calls that are scheduled. If you look at the schedule, you'll notice that we're pretty much fully booked, you know, for the next couple of weeks with all of these calls. So, you know, I do recognize that certain people, you know, schedules will not line up with these calls, and we will, you know, we will handle those discussions offline to the extent possible, and I'm happy to discuss it further with you today. If you would be willing to send me an email with your contact information, I can call you. And then with respect to your question about the time to register for those webinars, I would note that we've asked for people to respond by these times so that we can set up the webinars and the calls accordingly. To the extent that we get people who register for meetings late, there were many people who registered late for this meeting, we will welcome you onto the call. It will impact the, you know, how easy it is for us to run the call, and we'll have to make some changes logistically, but we would appreciate as soon as possible if people can let us know and register for those calls. It just makes planning on our part a lot easier, and so we can get the documents out to people in an appropriate time frame. So I do, you know, thank you all for hanging in there. We have a lot of stakeholders we're working with, and we are trying to get all the information out to you in a way that's best for everybody.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Was there a previous notification about the detailed product calls that was sent out, or was this presentation the first notification?
We've sent out notification about these detailed product calls for the past 4 weeks, I believe, including that with the program-wide webinar. So I think most people have seen this information, but it's possible if you didn't, you know, read the whole email that you wouldn't have noticed that we had all these calls scheduled. So, you know, certainly I hope there's people on this call here today who, you know, if they didn't know we were having these calls, the reason I mentioned it is because I wanted people to register for them. So I would just encourage you, the deadline was yesterday, but just if you can just register as soon as possible, that would be much appreciated.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Marvin, before we go to the next question, I did want to note we only have a few more minutes of call, so I don't know how many more questions that is, but, you know, if your question's urgent for today, I would love to answer it, and if we can deal with it on one of the product-specific calls and let one of the more general calls questions go through that, I think that would be the best for everyone on the call.
Very good. Our next question is from Rezwan Parekh with CyberTech Lighting. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I was calling about the, or I had a question about the disqualification. I'm in the lighting side or lighting industry. There are cases where we have a contracted manufacturer who is selling a similar product or the same qualified product. Maybe he's done the qualification to another competitor. If the product is tested or it's been chosen to be tested for that competitor and it's the same product for myself, if he disqualifies, would that disqualify my product? Will it also disqualify
the original factory that's producing it for both of us?
Yes, if there's a product that fails testing and there's other products out there just like that, you wouldn't want consumers buying it and thinking it was Energy Star, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, does that work where as if one passes, does my product also have to be tested for that same model down the line?
Well, I think that would depend on whether we knew that it was the same model, the same as that other model or not. And so to the extent that this is a broad issue for lighting, we could talk about how we can make that information more transparent to EPA in the lighting call to make sure that, you know, the selection process takes that into account.
Now, when we do submit it on the back of the manufacturer itself. So, you know, there is a manufacturer model as well as our model that's given, and where it might be the same case with another competitor of ours. So
mm-hmm.
that information is there. I'm not sure if it's crisscrossed by you guys, but it is there.
Well, I would think we would probably want to take that into consideration for sure in the selection of products for testing. So we could talk about the best way to make that happen. And if we thought there was some need that we needed to test the same model from two different manufacturers, I don't want to rule that out, but, at least we would be aware of it rather than, just doing it without that knowledge. Then, I think that's still a possibility, but we can discuss further.
Because it does incur costs for the same thing. It's
mm-hmm.
I appreciate your call. Well, I appreciate your information. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
Our next question is from Ken Ryder with California Energy Commission. Please go ahead.
Hi, Kathleen. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
I was just wondering, in terms of you were mentioning that you would be sharing information with other government entities that work for the California Energy Commission. I was curious if that we might fall into that category. And a second question I had is whether the state of California would be an entity that you would see as a entity that could challenge, because one of the things we do our own testing and verification of certification, and if we come across something, would you accept a challenge from the state, or would that be something that would need to go down a different venue?
Oh, I think we should definitely talk about how we want to work together on this as another type of government program, especially if we both are doing testing. I think we want to, talk about the best ways of sharing that information, make sure that what we've outlined here so far makes sense, and then, of course, talk about these issues around, if one government entity thinks there's a need to challenge a product, we need to figure out the best way to make that happen. So it may make sense for us to just schedule a call offline to discuss that.
Okay, I'll send you an email to follow up on that, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye.
Our next question is from Stan Rodriguez with Makita USA Incorporated. Please go ahead.
Hi, Kathleen. I was looking at the slide 36 where you talk about all products would have to be retested within a three-year period for verification. And past experience has shown that other neural labs do spot checking. And if you... And my experience also has shown that the cost of a third-party lab to do these tests gets pretty high. In general, I would imagine, I don't know the exact number, but I imagine the cost would be maybe $10,000 to $15,000 per test. And if you have a number of samples out there to be tested, it could be quite expensive. Has there been any thought in doing spot checking where you would pick, maybe a few each year or something, instead of having to test every item out in the market?
Depending on the product category we're talking about, I think we should continue that discussion, whether it's spot checking or maybe it's not every 3 years, but it's every other, different number of years. If it's a very expensive product, is there a way to lessen those costs and dovetail it with other testing that's going on? I think there's a number of things we need to talk about here depending on the product. And the 3 years is based on the requirements we have in place right now, but we're willing to discuss alternate options with manufacturers on a product-specific basis if there's if there's, you know, huge cost considerations or other considerations we need to take into account. So I would encourage, you know, I know that that will come up on probably most of the calls that we have around this, and we can continue that discussion. I will note that right now it's 1 o'clock right now. So I would just say if there's, you know, Marvin, if we have somebody who has one question that has to be answered right now, I'm happy to take it. And otherwise, I don't want to keep people on the line any longer. And, you know, we'll have these opportunities for continued discussion. And if it's something that can't wait for then or doesn't fit into one of those discussions, then I'm also available and you have my contact information.
We do have one more question. It's from Angelo Marasco with ODL.
Yeah, this was just a housekeeping thing, and I almost missed the meeting as well due to for a similar reason that Chuck brought up. And for whatever reason, and I don't know if anyone else has had this problem, but I was waiting for your email, but I didn't see it until I checked my junk email. So there was something about how the email went out, and that's just maybe a subtle point for people to recognize, because I you did send it out in a timely manner, but I almost missed it myself because it was in a place I don't normally look.
Okay. Yes, I would say that if people can just fix your junk mail folders, that's something that we can't really do on our end. It's something
right.
that I know everybody's email system is different, and so you know we do try to get information out to everybody. And if you have concerns about you know if you have concerns about mail not getting to you, that is another reason that we try to keep everything as up to date on our website as possible with information about upcoming calls and other information. So I would urge you to go there too to check. And if you know if the email system isn't working, we will try to fix those glitches. All right. Well, thank you all very much for your time today, your wonderful questions, for listening through a lot of content that we had to present on this. I do look forward to continuing our conversations over the next couple of weeks on all of these topics in a lot more detail. I think it will really add to the information that we have on which to base our draft of requirements that we develop. So I just want to thank you all and, you know, let you know that we're, you know, you have my contact information and email addresses and websites, and hopefully you feel like you can reach out to us if you need to with any questions. I encourage you to all remain engaged in this process as we develop and finalize all these requirements, and look forward to making all of this happen. So thank you all again, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.